on this episode of Rebel Spirit Radio.
So I would suggest that people go non-denominational. And also, one very important thing is that people need to listen to themselves. Like stuff coming from the inside, what I at times call the epistemological pipeline, that's for real. You can discard it and say, no, this has no value for me. But you can't impose someone else's valuing structure upon that as a religion, as the parents, as society. It must be you who raise a critical voice if it's something that doesn't agree with you. But otherwise, you should look at everything that comes from yourself as something highly relevant. Because, you know, what could be more relevant than a signal from yourself?
Welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio, exploring the frontiers of spirituality, consciousness, the esoteric, and humanity's sacred relationship with a living earth. I'm your host, Nick Mather, and in this episode, Carl Abrahamson returns to Rebel Spirit Radio to discuss his latest book, Meetings with Remarkable Magicians, Life in the Occult Underground. Carl discusses his interactions with key figures in the occult world, such as Anton LaVey and Genesis P. Orridge, and he reflects on the philosophical underpinnings of magic, the role of the transcendent in human culture, and the importance of integrating magical experiences into everyday life. Also, please be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. Your support is truly appreciated. Carl Abrahamson is a writer, publisher, magico-anthropologist, philosopher, filmmaker, and photographer. Since the mid-1980s, he has been active in the magical community, integrating occulture as a way of life and lecturing about his findings and speculations. He is the author of several books, including Occulture, Anton LaVey and the Church of Satan, Source Magic, and is the editor and publisher of The Fenris Wolf. He joins me today to discuss his latest book, Meetings with Remarkable Magicians, Life in the Occult Underground. Carl, welcome back to Rebel Spirit Radio.
Thank you very much. It's very good to be back.
Yeah, well, I'm very happy to be able to speak with you again. I love the opportunity. I've thoroughly enjoyed the last conversations we had, the first two.
Yes.
And I really appreciated the book because the book gave me more insight into who you are.
Yeah.
And I was referring to it, I don't think you ever mentioned this, but I was referring to it as a magical memoir.
Yeah. 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 You could say that. It's like, call it a magical autobiography in a way.
Yeah.
Because it has elements, of course, of my own chronology and my own reasonings and projects and whatnot, but there's also, I hope, you know, conveying the sense of magic or the magical flow that sort of guided me and pushed me along. And I don't mean that as being, you know, it being pushy in any way, but it's just like you can look at a human being's chronology in so many different ways. And I think I write in the introduction that I don't really look at it as purely chronology. It's more like a palimpsest, you know, or a puzzle. All the pieces aren't put in at exactly the right. But anyway, you know, and also, of course, some key phases in life overlap, you know, with each other. So I think that I'm very happy with it because it's kind of, I would say, a fairly unique life story. Mm-hmm. And I'm very happy about it. And I'm also very happy to have been able to formulate it, because I'm certainly, hopefully, not at the end of my life, basically entering the autumn years, maybe. But for me, it's been very, very good to do this. I mean, from a you know, emotional, psychic, mental point of view, and magical too, just like formulating. And as I write in the book also, the working title was 2x Saturn, signifying now at the very end of my second Saturn return. So that should lead into an interesting third phase, whether it's the last third of my life or whatever, we'll see. But these first two, you know, Saturn loops have been very, very interesting. And it was great to be able to formulate having that as a frame of reference in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. I just want to say, I hope you're not at the end of your life, because you are just 1 year older than me.
Right.
So if you are, you're dragging me with you. Yeah. Curiously, and I just want to ask about that Saturn return, because I know, and you don't really go into a lot of details about this in the book, but it's just a question that I have. I know that often that first Saturn return
is characterized as being a time of kind of painful transformation. And I know mine was definitely. But the second Saturn return, isn't that often thought of as Saturn giving you gifts for doing the hard work?
Well, I think without any extensive knowledge about sort of the theory of astrology and sort of different aspects like that, I would say it definitely is correct when I look back at my life. At around, 29, 30 wasn't really pleasant. I felt kind of unindividuated, although at that time in life one really should have, but I certainly wasn't. I had done a lot of trench work in various occult orders but I didn't feel fully formatted in any way. That came much later. And I do think that now, as you say, the sort of these gifts for doing the hard work, I feel that every day. It's a very, very wonderful feeling. And I think that's one of the reasons also it coincides with the release of this book, but it also coincides with me delving into kind of new territories where I've become more publicly available for that kind of, consulting and stuff like that, that I've previously not had a problem with, but it's been very, very occult in a way with dear trusted friends or people who have been in my circles in a way. But I felt that now that I've formulated so much of my, life experience and magical experience, part of my tradition is definitely, not only paying back, but also paying forward, bringing this spirit or cluster of philosophy and magic, whatever you call it, to people. And one of the ways to do that is, of course, keep writing books, which I will, but it's also interacting on a one-to-one level with people. And that's what I've called source magic, taking a cue from one of the essays in the anthology, Source Magic. And it's basically that everything we do, everything we are in human culture stems from a shamanic imprint. Whether it's religion, whether it's culture, whether it's science, all of these things come from that transcendental shamanic experience that is very, very, very ancient. The human need of transcendence is not just, get some kicks in the weekend, but it is really connecting with very, very deep strata of our psyche that were once upon a time absolutely quintessential for our survival. And I argue that's still the case.
And it was interesting. I was looking at my notes from Source Magic and comparing them to my notes for the current book. And I found a lot of overlap. And I wanted to talk to you about magic because one thing is, in the other books of yours that I've read, you're reporting from a more of an objective point of view. And since this is a memoir, it's personal. And that's one of the things I appreciated because I got a sense of your practice. And so I wanted to ask you about magic and how you understand it, because I think it's a very different way of thinking about magic, an important, and I think a philosophical way of thinking about magic.
I agree, and I'm happy that you say that. I think once upon a time, not too long ago, I think I formulated as magic is a very tolerant mind frame, which allows for all of the definitions of itself, i.e. magic, to pass through it, meaning that it could be so many different things to different people. Some are inclined to argue that it's the mind frame in ritual, in ecstatic moments. It's the mind frame that sets things free that you can sort of direct in theory, hopefully in practice too. Others would argue that no, it's the actual physical residue after these experiences. And others would claim that it's the interaction between human beings that create, this kind of third mind that takes on force and agency. And of course, what I mean by my explanation or formulation is that all of these things are true, of course. One thing that I have had happened to me or that I've allowed, to develop is a very loose and lax attitude that's more in line with Eastern thinking in a way. I am very much now in favor of absolutely non-denominational terminologies, whether it be religions or, even the so-called, division between the left-hand path and the right-hand path. First of all, I think very few people realize the original meaning of it and stuff like that. But I'm so fed up with the fact that some of the people, actually more in the left-hand path tradition, have become so arrogant in a way and quantitative. And it just, it irks me. It's not a big problem. But I've come up with this thing now under the Source Magic umbrella, which I call the no-handed path, which is that kind of, it's the middle path, it's being centered, it's not adhering to, either or. It's not either the physical or the spiritual. It's all of that and then some. And I think that many people may have formulated similar things before, but for me, it's been a great, wonderfully constructive process to actually sit down and think about these things and formulate them, if nothing else, for myself in my ongoing work. But I do feel that there are many kind of environments that are, almost inert, quasi-inert, in the sense that there's no new blood, there's no new thinking. There, I would argue that in some instances, there's no thinking at all. It's just blind repetition. It's like occultism by rote. And I don't think that will provide anything good. You might have some interesting results in the beginning, but it's not part, and this is another very important thing. If magic is not tightly connected to and integrated in the individual's individuation process, then it's everything is a moot point. Everything is pointless. It's just like, I learned how to drive a car, then I can drive a car. Yeah, I learned the rules of baseball, so I can play baseball. I learned how a remote works, so I can, watch TV. But it's on that level. You can have some interesting results when working in a specific magical system. But if that's not connected to who you really are and where you're going, meaning the larger existential questions in seen from an individuation point of view, then I would say it's almost pointless. It's like, I don't know, some kind of masturbation, but I certainly don't knock masturbation, on the contrary, but it's a solitary practice.
And that's one of the things I loved about the book and your thinking in terms of magic is that focus on the individual and the attempt to be a better person, that individuation that you're talking about. And that's also why I felt that it was necessary for me to include philosopher in the description because I saw it as I'm like, well, that's what philosophy is all about, is the or should be kind of about is that process of becoming a better human being, becoming a better person.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for that. I think that so many things now, including occultism, or as it's called now, esotericism, has been co-opted and coerced under the umbrella of academia. Philosophy is a longer existing patron under that umbrella. And it sort of makes everything very unsexy. It takes away, it abstracts things, it makes them, I don't know, unnecessarily complex. Because as you say, philosophy is all about, understanding life on the individual level, and then as becoming a better person, as you said. For me, it's I don't think about it. It's just something that I think about, meaning I don't sort of work with it on a conscious thing. Now I'm going to sit down and think about something, smart or well formulated. It's just that I have been blessed in that I have allowed myself to go in this intuitive direction of becoming, a magician, looking at culture from a magical point of view, thereby occulture, and all of these things, meaning basically when I don't look at the magic itself, but I look at things that contain the magic, that opens up these kinds of speculations and philosophical things. Whereas if I go too literal, look at the history of magic and go through something from a technical point of view, Crowley did this, Crowley did that, it really ends up in that sort of quasi-inert pool in a way. And for me, it's not fun anymore. It used to be fun up to a point, but then I realized that how things are changed, meaning real cultural historical changes, it's by much larger movements that are instigated by individuals who, carry a greater degree of agency than the so-called normal person. And I think that the main solvent, to use an alchemical term, is culture in itself. That's why if you want to change things, you use culture. And that's one of the things that I loved about Genesis Peorage, of course, and about LaVey also, and Anger too, for that matter, is that they used culture to disseminate their ideas. And that, of course, is much better than standing on the soapbox at the corner and being some kind of, zealot in a way.
And I agree with you from the, I mean, you are way better, way more knowledgeable about these things than I am. But from what I've looked at, I do see a lot in the occult and magical world that is kind of stagnant because it's focused on, and it's conservative in the sense of, well, let's do what they did. And it seems to me that the magic that you're talking about, especially with working with culture, it's progressive in the sense it is connected, and I would also say liberal in the sense of liberal connected to freedom.
Yeah, absolutely. You could argue that, freedom lies in the mind and stuff like that, and people can feel free even though they live in tyrannical societies. I wouldn't know because I've been also blessed by living in a society which is very, very, very liberal and secular. It's basically a very good place to grow up and to live. Can be dull sometimes, then you have the internet. But one of the things that you touched upon also is that people looking back, looking back, and it's like the grimoire craze, and looking back, oh, it was just unearthed, this spell book, whatever. And it's wonderful. And I think that it can work wonders for some people. For most, it's just a waste of money, basically. But the reason why all these things are happening, according to me, is, a very Jungian perspective. I believe that the collective unconscious, meaning us all together, and the sort of basically like the real internet, are sending signals to all the nodes, to all the people online, that we need to do something about the current situation, otherwise we'll be extinct. And I think that any kind of connection to the transcendental mind frame we talked about before, meaning any kind of magical entry, doorway, path, is good. And that's why I would never argue with someone whose magic I don't respect, whether it be something too airy fairy and new agey or something too harsh or so-called left-hand path, or it doesn't really matter. It doesn't matter if it's packaged in a streaming series with twitches, tween witches forever, or if it's something that is an old Icelandic spell book that was unearthed and contains, grim stuff. To each his own, whatever floats the boat. I think the main message here is that why are people to such a degree, actually more than ever before, attracted to these topics, attracted to these symbols, attracted to these possible behavioral changes? For me, it's a no-brainer. It's because somewhere deep inside, we know that we have to change our ways. And I'm not saying this from a moralistic point of view or blaming anyone. I would think we all have to take the blame for what's going on. But there is a way to change it, and that's the individuation. We have an individual enlightenment or illumination that is so strong that it carries impact even the day after, as opposed to psychedelics in many cases, where you have a great, trippy experience and it's, mind altering and you feel so changed in the moment. But then you go back to work the next day and everything's the same. But how should we deal with encouraging people to go transcendental and be changed? And then let that linger on so that it also leads to actual behavioral changes, because that's basically what needs to happen. And I think it was interesting, unfortunately, the COVID thing led to a very, very massive decrease of traffic and air traffic. Many things were put on halt in a way. And scientists could see immediately that the levels of negative things, harmful things, decreased. There were lower levels. So, of course, change is possible. It's just there needs to be enough people to implement it. And that's the real challenge when there's so much narcotic bling on all the screens and in, self-medication or actual medication, just, hindering people from, I don't know, have these epiphanies.
Well, I like what you were saying in terms of you used the analogy of a psychedelic experience and the person having this like amazing experience, but then just going back to work the next day. And what immediately came to mind is, well, yeah, they're not integrating that experience. And then I started thinking as you were speaking, I'm like, oh, yes, this is part of what magic is integrating that individuation into your life and then being able to take that and make a profound effect within the culture.
Absolutely. And I think that's why magic should also be culturally integrated and encouraged, whichever system, whatever, in whichever culture, because it's kind of a parallel strain, isn't it? The magical path, we begin by being attracted to some kind of symbolic language, and it speaks to us. We feel a resonance, and we walk down that path, and then we learn, and we sort of maybe master things, and then we come to a point where we're saying, this is no longer relevant for me. I mean, it's the same thing in life in general. Most people actually do change paths. They don't stay in the same careers forever. I mean, many people do, but people who feel inert to the point where it's like really dragging them down, they usually, get a new job or move or do something. And I see it as very similar in that sense. So you could say that maybe a magical path is a kind of a microcosmic a reflection of the main life story. I think that's how it should be. They should be really, really connected.
And it's I'm trying to think how I want to say this. I think so many people, and I can really only speak in my experience in the United States, so I don't want to assume this is the case everywhere, but for the longest time, I think most Americans, even though we love to, beat our chest and say this is the freest country in the world, it's not. And I always think back to Henry David Thoreau and Walden, where he said, the mass of men lead lives of quiet desperation. And I always see that as, and he says that he went to Walden to live deliberately. And there's that with that freedom. And it seems to me that there is, to kind of stay with this idea of freedom and the magic, is that it is taking that control of your life. And you wrote a bit about, and I wanted to talk to you about this, about time. And you also mentioned the memento mori again, in terms of how we look at our lives. And it seems to me that that idea of time is crucial. And you wrote that the key to a good life was and is to control your own time.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's, one of those cornerstones that you don't really fully understand until you are in that situation where you can control your time. I would argue also that you fully understand it when it's taken away from you, like when you've experienced it and then suddenly it's not possible anymore. So I think that brings a sense of so many good things from, of course, decreased stress, the imposition of energies you don't want in your sphere, to also developing a sense of responsibility. Because if you understand that you are free, you have to cultivate it, you have to nurture it, you have to be grateful. And that's where maybe some kind of spirituality comes into it. You have to feel sort of reverence and gratitude to the fact that I can wake up whenever I want to wake up. And then I work with stuff that I love to work with. And then I go to bed. Or do other things also exactly when I want to or feel to. And it's an amazing thing. And for me, it's a fairly recent thing that I've come to this level. And that in itself is the result of hard labor in the trenches of writing and publishing and doing a lot of things. But yeah, it's a joy and a blessing. And itself, it's like maybe not a crown, but it's definitely wonderful, clean fuel for the vehicle for as long as the vehicle runs. And yeah, I think that, and also being sensitive to seeing synchronicities, is also a good thing. Because synchronicities for me have always been kind of a sign language saying that, yeah, you're on the right path. Your mind is being free in moving on this path, and that's why you're seeing these The synchronicities, that's where they happen. They might happen also on other paths, but there you are so disturbed, or the energy is so polluted in a way that you simply don't see all the glorious, beautiful connections that are being made every second. So I think that's part of maybe a long-term transcendental experience when you become more not only susceptible to, but also perceptive to noticing what's going on around you on other levels than the merely causal, material, quantifiable.
Yeah. So it seems like living like that, and in the terms of magic, it almost seems like it is being aware or awake. Let me use that word, awake to your own life.
Yeah, totally. And that's why I also feel, I don't know, I think blessed is a very good word. I feel very blessed to have this freedom while working on myself through the stuff that I love to work with, which is kind of a meta level because it's also about magic itself, you know. So it's that's sometimes I call myself like a meta magician in a way, because I do the magic, but part of my magic is also about magic itself.
I love that in the book where you refer to yourself as a meta magician. Why don't we kind of shift gears just a little bit and talk about your, if you will, your magical pedigree? Because you've known some very interesting people and that have informed the magician you have become. And it,
Totally.
yeah.
Yeah. It's I wish I had like an easy explanation to it, and I don't. It could be, you know, in the astrology, or it could be karmic, I don't know. But again, that also makes me feel very blessed and grateful, because at a very early stage, and I'll give you an example that's very current here. I think 2 weeks ago, Vanessa, my wife, and I, we went to Stockholm, which used to be our hometown, but it's no longer. And it was the first time in 2.5 years. So it was needed to be something special to drag us there. And it was, I was invited to introduce two new films. One is the new Genesis Peorich documentary called She Is Still Here. And the other one is a documentary about members of the Church of Satan called Realm of Satan. So it was kind of a double bill at this beautiful cinema. And I introduced it, tried to, you know, keep it short, but I told this story again, which is also in the book, about how I was involved with Genesis Peorich and the Temple of Psychic Youth because of my interest in these things, but I loved them because they were doing something that was highly contemporary, was inspiring, wasn't just like a museum of magic. And at that time, you know, nine, being 19, 20, I had a band, of course, because that's what you do. And I wrote a song together with my band members called Sweet Jane, which was like a love song or an ode to Jane Mansfield and her relationship specifically with Anton LaVey, who was another kind of occult hero of mine. And when that record came out, Genesis said, "Well, why don't you send this record to LaVey? I have his address because we met recently in San Francisco." And I thought, you know, what the hell? So I did. And then I got this letter back from LaVey making me a member, and that led to the friendship and visits almost every year in San Francisco, and really a life-changing experience. And what dawned on me when I introduced these films, telling that story, first with a bit of LaVeyan perspective and then with Genesis perspective, it's like, what a an amazing moment. Like, what if I hadn't sent that record? What if I hadn't made that record? You and I wouldn't be sitting here talking. You know, it's like these things that create chains of events that are totally cosmic. So it dawned on me that trusting your intuition is very, very important. And I've tried consciously and unconsciously to do that as much as possible. So I was already involved with the Temple of Psychic Youth and working with Jen, not only on the magical stuff, but also on creative projects. And then the LaVey thing. And on the same trip as I met LaVey for the first time, I also met Anger for the first time, because I had just written at Stockholm University a thesis in film studies called Aleister Crowley's Influence in Kenneth Anger's Films. And that was part of the why he welcomed me. But the main thing was actually that LaVey had called him and said that Carl is a cool guy, you know. So it was already like these fast interactions and doors opening. And then at about the same time, of course, when I was 23 years old, I joined the OTO, and I stayed with the OTO for 30 years and met a lot of interesting people through that. And then I worked with this American guy, David Griffin, on the in the Golden Dawn section that stemmed from Regardee, the Stella Matutina lineage, and yeah, and so many other people too that came in from basically the cultural world, but who also contained great magical power and potency, and who obviously must have seen something in me. I don't think, I hope not, that it's only the accumulation of like celebrity status that makes this happen. But then on the other hand, I remember when I was young, I thought the people with many occult books on their shelves were cooler magicians than those who had few, you know? So you don't really realize those things until you come to a de degree of maturity and you understand that magic is really about energy. It's the contained energy, preferably in a vessel that's not, you know, loco, that it's sane, restrained, has agency. Because I met some loonies too, not that I wrote on them. But so I cannot explain my pedigree, but what's happened now at this point, again, after two times Saturn, is that most of the original mentors are now gone, deceased, gone to another level. And you know, Anger died last year. And for me, they have been very, very important. And I could see them working in traditions also, meaning, for instance, from Genesis, there's the Brian Gysin and William Burroughs lineage. And they all contain the same kind of spirit, basically. And it's, I would call it libertarian or you know, for liberty, call it encouraging of individuation, regardless of what symbols you put into the potion. And it's one where you, I've called it altruistic selfishness. It means that you are involved in things that make you feel good because the best way to affect other people is by positive inspiration. And if you're you know, suffering, you won't inspire anyone. So I think that it's a, I am the carrier now of a tradition, and I'm very aware of it, and I'm doing my best to formulate these things. I'm writing now about the no-handed path and the source magic thing, and working more with the source magic mentorship, meaning I'm trying to be as active as these people were when they received me in a way. It's part of the job. It's a very important part to move it forward.
I'll just say I was a little bit jealous reading the book because, and it's, I think it's cultural in many ways, because you grew up in Stockholm, you're in Europe, and you know, and I know that Anton LaVey was in the US and whatnot, but you know, there's, I think there's a big difference between someone who lives in Stockholm versus someone who has a small town in the middle of Kansas pre-internet. You know, and so, you know, and you could see people like in the larger cities here, you know, New York, Los Angeles would have these opportunities. So much of it was just the roll of the dice in terms of where you were born in some ways.
Yeah, absolutely. I think also one of the reasons why I was visible in this, you know, vast darkness in a way was the Fenris Wolf, you know, because the first issue was actually just like a fanzine that came out in 1989. And I had already been in touch with, of course, with Genesis and also LaVey, and I'd written a lot about anger at university. So I wrote about that for Fenris Wolf. And the first, there was really nothing like it. The IOT, the Chaos people, they had Chaos International, their fanzine or magazine was very good, shared a similar kind of eclectic aesthetic. And I think the Fenris Wolf was a door opener also, and became even more so. And that's again, you know, why, I mean, this just came the other day. It's Fenris Wolf
Oh,
number 12.
okay.
So it's like, you know, now they're big fat
Wow.
books where it used to be fanzines. And that's why I keep doing it, you know, is to carry on in that same spirit. Now it's, you know, it's more, it's well made, and it's a book, and you know, it's a great network of contemporary people writing about culture. And it's, again, it's part of my job.
Well, and I think that's the admirable part is it's a the model of following your passion and sticking to it. And
Yes. Yeah.
that's how you develop these and create these relationships and these networks. You know, I didn't grow up in the middle of Kansas, but I did grow up in a small town in Ohio. And I've heard other stories of people, in the larger cities. And like I said, I get a little jealous, but then I'm like, well, you know what? But I'm actually talking to a lot of people now. So it came
Exactly.
about. So I can't be, too upset about it. I do want to ask, because this is the first time if I remember correctly, that you wrote at any length about Aleister Crowley. And one of the things that you wrote about him, and I really appreciated this because this is how I've kind of thought about him. You said that what you liked most about him and still do was his way of life. And I've often thought, and I'll just say this and then see if I can get your reaction. I've heard some people say that, oh yeah, he was such a great magician. Look at how he died. And he was like, impoverished. I'm like, look at how he lived. He lived the way he wanted to, and that's where the magic was.
Yeah, absolutely. It's no doubt that, he was whatever term he ascribed to himself. He was. I would probably not call him a prophet, because that's one of the things that has increasingly irked me, and I think in part led to my departure from OTO in 2019, was an increased sense of religiosity stemming from basically the other Crowleyan order, not the OTO specifically, where people seem to have, seem to have lost all sense of humor. It's like it's everything so, deadpan serious, and I think that, whoa, what's going on here? Now that there's suddenly this talk about, the prophet, and it's just so fucking serious. And I think that those people who've taken on those roles, one key such person died recently, they probably come from religion. They probably come from monotheist religious backgrounds, just like Crowley did. And Crowley also used this sort of pompous language and proclaimed himself to be the prophet. Good magic for you, Al, that you managed to, convince these goofies later on that you actually were. I think the main thing that's a takeaway from Crowley is the philosophy of Thelema. It's again this tying in with the German philosophy of will, not just through Nietzsche, but also Schopenhauer. And Schopenhauer tied it in with, Vedanta in a way, or Indian philosophy. And that's brilliant. And that was Crowley's brilliance. From a magical point of view, he was brilliant in the sense that he was a syncretist. He synthesized, take some yoga, take some meditation, take some Western ceremonial magic, spice it up with a little Kabbalah. It's a good mix of stuff. Whereas he had problems himself, I think, in fully entering the new aeon that he claimed to have ushered in. He was still a very, very old aeon in a way. But I do think that, again, like the takeaway, the real gem of that system is the philosophy itself. Because if you strip away the magic, what do you have? It's like the magician's, what do you call it? The emperor and the clothes. What's
Oh,
that?
yeah. The emperor has no clothes.
Yeah, exactly. The magician has no clothes. Magician has no magical tools, because if there's no guiding direction, there's no agency to move the machine along a path that leads to something that is fulfilling. Then again, you're on the inert stage. You're just treading there. And again, I feel almost tired of the analogy or the metaphor, but I love it so much. And it's the Sorcerer's Apprentice in Fantasia. Mickey Mouse, tries the spell book, to cut corners, we should add. He does it to cut corners. And that's not a good thing. And then, of course, the real magician becomes, angry. And I can see that very much. It's a problem when there's simply so much technical material. Crowley was so prolific, right? He created a system. And what do Western people specifically, and I would argue Western males specifically, what do they like? They like systems, right? So if it is a system that seems impenetrable, of course that will be incredibly attractive to that kind of what Freud would say, the obsessive mind. It never ends. It's just this endless, pinpointing and churning and turning the things, small screws, whatever, in order to, I guess, understand the machinery. But there are other ways to there are always other ways to understand the machinery. And I think, again, Crowley lived a great life. He was a great magician, and I'm
Right.
sure he had some great times, and he sure could appreciate that, meaning he was self-aware enough. But then his own religious background backfired. He had very unresolved mummy issues, and people seemed to have a hard time getting it. And I'm certainly not claiming that, oh, I've understood it. It's just my own interpretation after having worked the system and reading him for 30 years, that he was far from finished. And I think it's kind of sad, or maybe it is what Robert Anton Wilson or others would have called like a cosmic joke almost.
Right.
Like people fall prey to the rebel in a way, but in the same way as what he rebelled against. You know, where
Yeah.
the rebel becomes projected upon as being the Messiah in a way.
Right.
It,
Right.
it's kind of paradoxical, but it seems to be the case because some of the stuff that I've read from these people, meaning a certain kind of Thelemite, is just hilarious, but it's also very negative because it affects people who should be focused on refining, first finding and then refinding and refining their own will.
Yeah.
Not read that kind of sort of quasi-religious gobbledygook.
Yeah. Well, dogma seems to be entirely antithetical to magic.
Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So you had mentioned the kind of turn to the East, and I know that Crowley did write about yoga. I think that's, isn't that like the first book in book four, or the big book, I think, is on yoga. And you wrote in the book a little bit about your observations of Tibetan Buddhism. You and Genesis were in Nepal, I think, a couple of times, perhaps. Nepal has a place in my heart. So I was wondering if maybe you could comment on the connections that you we're seeing between Vajrayana, which is the Tibetan Buddhism, and magic.
Yeah, absolutely. It was actually the in the book I write about the creation of the Institute of Comparative Magical Anthropology. And the first expedition that we made in the mid 90s was first one trip to India in 96, where we stayed for 2 months in northern India and spoke to, you know, monks and nuns and lamas and even met the state oracle of Tibet, or the medium for the state oracle, and people like that, and also the ones doing the publishing at the Tibetan library. And it's just like incredibly inspiring trip. But we had an agenda. We actually interviewed these people about their views on magic. And it was a kind of a mixed bag of stuff. Some were maybe too dogmatic in a way or reluctant, but they're also so sweet and so devoted to their path that you can't really argue. And why should you? You know, they're doing their thing. But we could certainly find what we were after in a way when talking about ritual in itself and what ritual does. Because Vajrayana is so very, very ritual compared to Theravada or the southern forms of Buddhism. So that was very interesting. And then we carried on 3 years later by going to Nepal and then Tibet proper, and also focus a bit on the Bon, some Bon monasteries. And same thing there. In Tibet, we chickened out a little bit in the sense that we didn't really dare ask monks and nuns about these things because everything was so heavily monitored.
Right.
But we could watch firsthand what daily monastic life was and document that. It became a very beautiful photo book because one of the participants is a beautiful photographer. It's called Bardo Tibet. And there's a text in there that touches upon some of these things. But much of that material is actually unexploited. So it's been lying in
Wow.
waiting for almost 30 years now. But, you know, we will deal with that at some point. If nothing else, maybe portion it out in the Fenris
Yeah.
Wolf. It was very, very interesting. And I have to say, it was an awakening for me magically, because at that time, mid-90s to the beginning of the new millennium, I had been so immersed in Western ceremonial magic and its symbols, the trippy aspects of the Golden Dawn system, and the slightly darker yet very, very, yeah, beautiful system of the OTO, and then other kinds of magic that I was involved in, including the satanic. And I think that being in a Bon, what they call the protector's chamber, like a ritual room at the Bon monastery in Dolanji and in India, which is like the main Bon Monastery, where the equivalent of the Dalai Lama for the Bon religion lived at the time. And he was very, very, nice and accommodating. But being in that room with black walls and intricate gold and like silver symbols, and their drumming and these intense crashes from the cymbals, much more, I would say, powerful in a way for me than the normal Vajrayana Buddhist stuff, where you have these large halls and everything's kind of bright. The Bon stuff was really dark. And that made me realize there and then that, wow, so much of what I've tried to emulate in a way or find in these Western systems is right here in this room. The darkness that brings something else, the working with frequency, the working with energy, the tying into tradition, the tying into transcendental mind frames, it was all there. And so I think that was really literally a crash course in how magic really works. Whereas if you're in your own temple, in your own space, and you work with a Crowley ritual and you do this, oh, wait, I forgot to do this here. It's like it becomes so intellectual, so mental, and you need to wash that away. It's like LaVey said so beautifully that the ritual space should be the intellectual decompression chamber. You need to wash that away temporarily. And that's something I learned very much there. So yeah, they know what they're doing, and the Buddhists do too. I would say in Vajrayana is the Nyingma sect, that's the most open-minded in that sense for working with stuff. But I mean, I had telepathic experiences. I write about that in the book with an older monk, and I felt it a couple of other times also, meaning they are simply so advanced in their training that they can tune in and sort of meet you on other levels than the merely rational, intellectual, verbal. And for Westerners, it's like, whoa, so wait, is this real? Yeah, you realize, wow, it's real because these people have been doing it for, actually thousands of years. And they're so advanced, and we are just little goofies with the swelling bookshelves, as you can see behind me.
And
That
behind
in
me.
itself, yeah, you're right, exactly. That in itself is not magic. It contains magical knowledge. But then, of course, you have to work with it and turn it in, translate it into workable energies. And that's again something I find best where you go completely non-denominational, in a way, anarchic. I'm not saying anarchistic, I'm saying anarchic, meaning that you're outside of any kind of group or power system, power structure that tries to control it. Because in the Western mind frame, that's inherently there. Even in the magical structures that are supposed to set you free, there's always power tripping. So I would suggest that people go non-denominational. And also one very important thing is that people need to listen to themselves, like stuff coming from the inside, what I at times call the epistemological pipeline. That's for real. You can discard it and say, no, this has no value for me, but you can't impose someone else's valuing structure upon that as a religion, as the parents, as society. It must be you who raise a critical voice if it's something that doesn't agree with you. But otherwise, you should look at everything that comes from yourself as something highly relevant, because what could be more relevant than a signal from yourself?
There's just this tendency, and I've seen this in myself of I think I don't know where the resistance comes from, but there's this tendency to think that what came before is better and that you have to adhere to some kind of system. And maybe it gets into that notion of freedom where we have to learn to free ourselves, listen to ourselves, as you say, and then we can actually start working magic.
Yeah, I think so. I absolutely think so.
One of the questions, though, is in regards to magic and our culture, is that we live in such a materialist culture that, essentially, matter is all there is, and magic is an impossibility. How do you respond to that as, someone who has explored the magical traditions and for the past, most of your life?
Yeah, I think that again, I would draw the attention to the source magic concept, meaning that everything we do, all the facets of human culture right now, including the rational natural sciences, etc., the empirical method, they're all like electrons in orbit around a proton, and the proton is the source magic. It's the heritage that we have so deeply ingrained within us, which is both, yeah, containing philosophy. It's also containing an attitude, contains, it's very tightly connected to the survival instinct. We have this because we needed it at some point to survive, to use fast reactions, non-intellectual approaches to surviving, fight or flight, and then various facets of that. And anyone who would argue, I mean, sometimes I pull up this card from my sleeve in a way, and when people talk about the empirical method and science being, superior because it's, quantifiable, you can measure it, etc. But what is the foundation of the empirical method? It's wild speculation,
Right.
right? Because all the ideas come from somewhere. And where do these ideas come from that are churned through the grinding of the method, of the empirical method? Comes from people's unconscious, comes from random chance. It comes from third minding with other creative scientists. It comes from psychedelic experiences, etc., etc., etc. It's not about cogitation. Cogitation comes in much, much later. And then, of course, it sort of presupposes that you're working with logic. But
Right.
logic is just like one little facet in the toolbox, one
Yeah.
little tool in the toolbox. And I think that when you look at it from that point of view, it's like everything begins with what we have inside already. It's not hocus pocus. It's just, existential fact, I would say, validated through an existential empirical method for thousands, hundreds of thousands of years as humans have developed. It's all about that proton, which is the source magic. It's a
Yeah.
shamanic approach
Right.
to understanding the sphere around us, but also what's inside us. And the more people fight that, the more they try to distance by adhering instead to these proxies, the more problems we have.
Yeah. Yeah, I what comes to mind is actually a couple of things. One is Nietzsche and the distinction between the Apollonian and the Dionysian. And that, we need the rational, but we also desperately need that ecstatic, the Dionysian ecstatic, and that is the shamanic. Yeah.
Absolutely. And also the shamanic state brings fodder for the Apollonian mind frame to work with. It's
Right.
just everything has an origin story. Everything has a kind of an epistemology.
Yeah.
Everything comes from somewhere.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's impossible to, deduct and see the actual roots of things. Because, again, what's beyond where space ends? That's the stuff that makes you crazy thinking about. But there's always something beyond everything.
Yeah.
And it goes for, watching nature with our mere eyes instead of using technology. Sometimes that can be more revealing than going so close that it becomes more like an abstracted artwork.
Yeah. Yeah, we need to experience it, I think, and not just rationally, but to find that connection with it. And yeah, that's my other issue. I have one quick question for you because I know we're running out of time. You and I both have to go, unfortunately. But there was one thing in the book that I wasn't entirely clear on, and I was hoping that you could maybe help clarify it for me. And that was the mega golem.
I'd be happy to. It's my pet
Good.
project.
Yeah.
The Mayer Golem is also initially a reaction to my being very fed up with the art world because I'd been peripherally involved in it all through my life, basically, because my mom worked at an art gallery and I, met so many weird neurotic artists, etc. And I found the same patterns in my own generation and in a younger generation too. It's like some kind of perpetuum mobile, which feeds off of the creative people's neuroses and insecurity. So I wanted to instead make an artwork that was completely invisible, not possible to touch, absolutely not possible to sell, just something that accumulates within the shared mind frame of the people involved. And I contributed originally some parts of the Mega Golem's body, and I invited other artists and magicians to do the same, and they didn't even have to tell me what they did. It was important that they did, and they did. So the Mega Golem now, according to in my perception, has a life of its own. It is a magical being. I can, command it or I can direct it. So in that sense, it's also experimental magic, but it's also tying in with the tradition of the golem in sort of in Jewish lore. But this is the mega golem, and it's made of basically contemporary art and magical theory. And I have one book out about the mega golem, which is an anthology of the stuff that I've written about it. And then also I'm working on a novel that will be called The Mega Golem and the Dancing Girl. That will be like an experimental novel. And that will also be a part of the mega golem's body in a way. I haven't decided which part, but it will be part of it.
Okay, so it's like a egregore.
Yeah, I could say
Yeah.
that. Absolutely.
Okay. All right. Wonderful. Well, I know that we are near just about out of time. Unfortunately, it's always such a pleasure to speak with you, Carl.
Thank you.
But let me ask you, you've kind of given a few hints on what you've got coming up, but is there anything else you would like to add about what you are working on?
I think both my wife and I, we're doing classes at Morbid Anatomy, and it's an ongoing thing where we talk about different things. We've talked about the cut-ups, we've talked about satanic magic. Right now I'm doing a class on occult cinema. Vanessa will do one about Tim Burton in December. I will do one about Kenneth Anger in February. Meaning it's kind of, I won't say master classes, but it's like going to school, but it's a cool school where you have four different sessions where you really go through a subject. And there's an opportunity for Q&A and stuff over at Morbid Anatomy Museum. And then, of course, many more books coming up. It's just now I'm releasing Meetings with a Remarkable Magician. I love it. It's my baby. I love it. And then, of course, New Fenris Wolves, many other books. It's just a constant outpouring of stuff, but it's for connecting with people.
Absolutely. And I love the book. I've enjoyed everything of yours that I've read. So,
Thank you.
and is there a place that you would like people to go to find out more about you and your work? I know that you and your wife have a Patreon.
Yeah, that's right. Our Patreon is patreon.com slash Vanessa23Carl, Vanessa23Carl. And then there's my site, which is simply carlabrahamson.com. And then the Fenris Wolf recently got a Substack together, and that's thefenriswolf.substack.com. It's more of a thing that contains reviews, shorter pieces by me, news about the books. It's really a go-to place for everything that I do. It's like, yeah, it has a kind of a newsletter function with lots of blog posts and stuff. It's a very happening place.
Okay, wonderful. I will put links for those in the show notes in
Thanks.
the video
Thanks.
description, as well as link for the book.
Wonderful.
I
Thank
should
you.
put links for other books, but I'll just focus on the one. But
Yeah.
I'll link to our previous conversations as well.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah. So, well, Carl, thank you again so much for your time. As always, it was very enlightening, and I hope that we can speak again at some time.
I hope so too, and we'll make sure it happens. I just have to write a new book, right?
Well, we can even talk sometime even
Yeah,
between books. So,
of course.
so all
Perfect. Thank
right.
you very
All right.
much.
All right. Thank you.
Okay,
All
bye.
right. Goodbye. And that's a wrap on episode 168 of Rebel Spirit Radio. Thank you so much for listening or watching if you are part of my YouTube audience. Now you know what's coming up next, all the usual. Sign up for my Patreon, share this with friends and family and on social media, subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. You know the drill. But the thing is, all of this is really important. Sharing, subscribing, following, they're all free and they only take a second of your time and they really do help. Right now, putting this podcast together is a labor of love and I do love it. And as many of you know, I'm in the process of making some changes to the podcast and the YouTube channel. It's slow going, but your support will help me speed up the process and ensure that I can continue with the podcast and offer much more content than what I provide now. As I always like to say, I'm here in the Front Range now doing missionary work in regards to religion, spirituality, and ecology, psychedelics, and consciousness, and how all of this can help us heal humanity's relationship with the sacred earth. So if you feel moved by the rebel spirit, and I sure hope that you do, then please, by all means, help me in my efforts to share the good news. I'm Nick Mather, and you've been listening to or watching Rebel Spirit Radio. Until next time, may you be in peace, may you flourish in all possible ways, and may you continue to nurture your rebel spirit.